In the age of social media, people spend a lot of time calling each other out.
Calling out culture assumes that there's only one right way to think about something, one right way to talk about something, and only a small number of words to use to talk about it. I call it the road rage of the internet.
Maybe there's a better way. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 2nd, taking on call-out culture with Loretta J. Ross, a radical Black feminist and human rights activist who says it's time to call in. She'll explain. Also on the show, why some big corporations might oppose a bipartisan bill to protect China's Uyghur population from forced labor. But first, yesterday was the first of the month, meaning that rent was due for millions of people in the United States. But the economic toll of the pandemic and the high rates of unemployment mean many Americans are struggling to pay that rent, and you told us about it.
Hi, this is Amy calling from Morristown, New Jersey. My mom's caregiver, she's a single mom with two kids. Somebody bought her building. She has to be out of there. They gave her until December 1st, and now they're giving her until the 5th. Like, she's looking frantically. I'm also looking frantically because we both notice that when a white lady calls, you get a lot farther. It's so frustrating. It's killing me. I don't know what she's going to do.
My name is CJ Abe, and I live in Seattle, Washington. I am a renter, and I am 3 months behind in rent. Neither of us can work because my wife has high risk factors for getting sick. The eviction moratorium in Washington ends at the end of this month. I am 29, and I have worked all my life and been poor all my life. It feels like my family's life are in the hands of my landlord, and I don't know what is going to happen.
And the situation for many tenants could get worse. According to research from the Aspen Institute, some 40 million more Americans could be facing eviction in the coming months as the CDC moratoriums on evictions is set to expire at the end of December. Some landlords, however, have skirted the CDC's eviction moratorium and have continued to evict tenants anyway. Other landlords say they're also struggling to make ends meet without being able to collect rent or fees.
Hi, this is Jennifer in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am a landlord. I'm also disabled, which means I can't work. That means most of the money I live off of comes from rent. However, I see renters as just fellow human beings, and we all are worthy of kindness and respect. I would not evict any of my tenants for missing a month or two if they could provide legitimate reasons for not being able to pay. They're humans.
Over the course of the pandemic, we've been keeping tabs on the housing crisis exacerbated by COVID-19, and we're bringing you the next chapter of that conversation today on The Takeaway. And joining me now to talk through this is Jerusalem Demsis, a reporter at Vox. Jerusalem, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Jenny Schutz, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Jenny, thanks for being back with us.
Good to be here.
Jerusalem, remind us again, the CDC moratorium is a federal national moratorium on evictions, and then states have had other sort of patchworks of moratoriums, but all of that is supposed to go away at the end of the month, isn't it?
Yeah, so the CDC's national eviction moratorium, which was implemented in September, is expiring on December 31st. Other states have and localities have implemented a patchwork of moratoriums. Some of them extend past the end of December. I mean, you have to check with your individual state, but a lot of them do expire. Places like Illinois, every month it has to be re-signed by the governor. So it really depends on the state and locality that you live in. But, you know, we are seeing that a lot of folks are going to be facing eviction at the end of the month because it's going to be a dire situation for folks when those do go away.
Jenny, what have the CDC protections looked like so far?
Well, in theory, the eviction moratorium is supposed to keep landlords from pushing tenants out if they have lost income due to the pandemic, they aren't getting federal benefits, and they have and they're below some income cutoff. So this is not a complete solution. It doesn't cover everybody in the first place, But the real weakness is that our rental system is very decentralized. Normally, landlord and tenant law is set at the state level. It's actually administered through county courts. And so the danger is that you may have two different judges in neighboring counties in the same state who interpret the moratorium differently. And since the judges are the ones who are actually litigating these claims, you can have tenants in similar situations who receive very different treatment. So this was sort of a band-aid to try to hold things together. But because of the way we've constructed the legal framework around renters, it was always going to face some real challenges on the ground.
Jerusalem, what are some of the ways that landlords have been able to exploit some of the loopholes in the law?
Yeah, so I think the fundamental thing here is that the federal government has really abdicated responsibility for making sure that renters can make rent. And so basically, landlords have been left to play the role of the social welfare state. And, you know, for some landlords, they've been able to absorb the loss of income. But, you know, most folks who are experiencing financial difficulty, they tend to be in industries like retail or construction, and they're disproportionately renters. And a lot of them are lower income. And so, you know, the incentive for their landlords to kick them out because they're losing money on those units is still there. So no eviction moratorium could ever take away that incentive. And like Jenny discussed, like, because there are differences between courts, there's a huge incentive for every landlord to try and make sure that the court interprets it in their favor. So you're seeing landlords, I mean, there are a lot of different examples of what they're doing, but the only thing the CDC eviction moratorium and most moratoriums does is it stops you from being evicted for non-payment of rent, but it doesn't stop you from being evicted for health and safety violations or, you know, other things that could cause you to lose your home, like breaking your lease in different ways. So a lot of there are some cases that I've talked to legal aid lawyers around the country about where there are, you know, a landlord will claim that a woman's child running through the hallway is a health and safety violation, or other ways that kind of seem to be really stretching the truth about what is actually occurring in these apartments. And the fact of the matter is that's going to happen until you provide a way for renters to actually make rent, because, I mean, these landlords are going to make a profit. They're not there to be a social welfare institution. And that's really the big problem here, is that the federal government hasn't provided the funding to make that happen.
Jenny, I want to break that down a little bit, because there are different kinds of landlords also, as there are many different kinds of tenants. There are landlords, I'm sure some of us in New York are familiar with these, and I'm sure throughout the country, that are bigger companies, they're management companies, they're really there to make a profit. They're almost like these entities rather than people. And then you have the smaller landlords, the folks maybe that we heard at the top of the show who might have a one bedroom or are renting a private home. How are they struggling differently during this pandemic, if at all?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So one way to think about this is in sort of the rent tiers or price tiers. The pressures are really hardest on low-income renters. As Jerusalem said, most of the job losses have been concentrated in areas like food service and retail. So lower-income workers are more likely to have lost their job and low income. They're more likely to live in what we call Class C apartment buildings. So usually older buildings, somewhat lower rent. And those are also buildings that generally don't have as much of a margin. They're more likely to be owned by these kind of small mom and pop landlords. You know, particularly in a small building, you can see how it would be problematic if you have a four-unit building or a duplex and you rent out. If only one or two of the renters in the building lose their income, the operating income for the entire building takes a really big hit. In a 200-unit building, a few people can't pay their monthly rent. It's less of an issue for the landlord, and they can keep the building running. So what we're really worried about are sort of these older, smaller buildings owned by small landlords, many of whom have mortgages, and they still have to pay the mortgage. They still have to pay property taxes to the local government, which is really important at the moment. And so many of these landlords don't actually have a lot of resources themselves, and they're going to be put in a financially difficult position. Potentially, some of these smaller buildings are going to wind up having to sell their property because they can't cover expenses. And that could have really dire repercussions for the renters who live in those buildings if the building winds up being sold.
That feels like that's just the beginning of a bigger spiral too, Jenny, just in terms of the loss of wealth in these communities. If you are a small landlord and you're forced to sell your property that was an income generating property, and now not only are the tenants forced to find a new place to live, but the small landlord also loses a source of income. And I mean, it just feels like this could really become a much bigger issue than we're potentially aware of at this point, no?
Absolutely. I mean, the rental housing crisis is going to have ripple effects throughout local economies. Landlords who can't make their payments means they're not, for instance, able to keep their staff on, you know, pay the building superintendent or the plumbers who come in to fix problems. The buildings may wind up becoming less habitable. One of the really important implications, if landlords can't pay property taxes, local governments aren't collecting revenue. We know that they're also taking a hit on property taxes from commercial properties. They're losing taxes from sales taxes and hospitality. And local governments are really on the front line of providing support, both in terms of public health and things like providing rent relief to renters who can't make payment. So when you sort of freeze the cash flow, everybody who's downstream of the rent payment is going to wind up not getting money.
Jerusalem, are there certain states that are attempting to mitigate what we're talking about here at the state level, at least, by providing relief to landlords or to renters?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of innovative solutions that are being attempted right now. I mean, one that Catherine McKay at the Aspen Institute pointed out to me was that Michigan is currently attempting to negotiate on behalf of renters directly with landlords to negotiate down back rent and make that payment through existing funds that they're getting from the federal government. You know, there are a lot of other ways, and there are a lot of other programs that could be repurposed this way, things like temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, which is a government program, or other community development grants. But it really requires the federal government to provide technical assistance to states to really outline how they could repurpose that funding and ways that they could use existing funds to help people and to make sure they stay in their homes. But just to add on to something that Jenny said, I mean, we've seen this before with our affordable housing stock after 2008's financial crisis. We saw a lot of America's affordable housing stock get bought up by larger corporations and private equity. And when that happens, it doesn't serve the same population anymore. A lot of times these apartment buildings get flipped and they get turned to serve higher income populations. And we were already in a crisis before COVID-19 hit, where people were not, there was not enough affordable housing for the amount of people that were demanding it. And so this is a really big problem, that if we're not able to get money into the hands of renters that are living in these affordable housing units, we're going to lose a large source of our affordable housing stock when we can least afford it.
Jenny, there was talk on the Hill yesterday in Congress about another relief bill. Was any of that potential relief going to be aimed at tenants or landlords?
Indirectly, yes. So one of the important components would be just extending the unemployment insurance programs so that households continue to get checks. What they were talking about yesterday is less generous than the program that existed through the summer, but it's certainly better than nothing. The other piece of the package they're talking about is providing aid to state and local governments. And that's really essential because state and local governments could step in. They can't cover the entire rent debt, but they can make up part of this. And we've seen actually that most of the large cities and a number of sort of large counties have developed rent relief programs where they help tenants who are behind on their rent cover a couple of months to stay in place. Or for those who will have to move, they provide first month's rent and security deposit for a new apartment. So that's a good way to help some number of tenants. There isn't nearly enough money for that. And actually, many of the local programs have already exhausted their funds. Another round of funding to state and local governments would help provide that, as well as the household financial support.
Let's hope something happens for so many Americans. Jerusalem Demsis is a reporter at Vox, and Jenny Schutz is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Jerusalem and Jenny, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A piece of legislation with unusually strong bipartisan support is reportedly facing opposition from some of the biggest corporations in the world. The Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act aims to end the use of forced labor from China's Uyghur Muslim population in products sold in the United States. But reports from the Washington Post and the New York Times say that companies including Apple, Nike, and Coca-Cola are lobbying to weaken the bill before it passes in the Senate. Reports issued by government officials and human rights groups have linked all three companies to forced labor in China. In statements to The Takeaway, both Nike and Coca-Cola denied lobbying against the bill. And you can find their full statements on our website at thetakeaway.org. Joining me now is Anna Swanson, who broke the story on Nike and Coca-Cola's lobbying efforts for the New York Times. Anna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are the central components of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act?
Yeah, so this is really broad, significant legislation, which basically would presume that all goods imported from Xinjiang, either made in Xinjiang or made with raw materials produced there, are produced by forced labor. And it would put the onus on the companies to prove that their factories are actually free of forced labor, as well as any goods that come from factories elsewhere in China that use laborers from Xinjiang in these kinds of poverty alleviation and worker training programs that sometimes move people around the country.
We mentioned that some of the companies that you found out about have denied that they are lobbying against the legislation. In a statement to The Takeaway, Nike disputed the reporting, saying, quote, that the company has not lobbied against the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act or any other proposed forced labor legislation. They also denied sourcing products from the Xinjiang region of China. And that, how does that square with your reporting, Anna?
Mm-hmm. So I think that they, you know, so companies sometimes hear quibble lobbying against. So lobbying records do show clearly that Nike, Coca-Cola, Apple, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and other entities have spent heavily lobbying on the legislation. They've lobbied on this issue in-house and then also hired outside firms to lobby Congress and other federal agencies on it as well. So speaking to congressional aides and other people familiar with the situation, they did characterize it as these companies lobbying to, you know, weaken or water down the bill. But it might depend a little bit on your perspective. So for Apple, I was able to obtain a document that showed their specific proposals to change provisions of the bill. And, you know, many of them make the scope of the bill more sort of narrow in some respects. And, you know, defenders from Apple's perspective say that they're trying to make this bill more realistic, make it more likely for their suppliers to comply. But, you know, from some the perspective of some human rights groups, they might see this as watering down as well. But yes, it's important to note that these companies do strongly deny. They say they're opposed to forced labor and that they carry out regular audits of their supply chains to eliminate it.
We're talking about the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act with Anna Swanson. This is The Takeaway. Anna, how much evidence is there that some of these companies have ties to forced labor in their Chinese supply chains?
Well, some of this has been documented through think tanks and media reports. So, you know, often it's the presence of, for example, in Nike's case, there were reports about some Uyghur workers in a Nike factory in eastern China. Nike did not deny that, actually, but said that that factory subsequently carried out an audit and that there are no longer any Uyghur workers there. For Coca-Cola, it was an issue with a supplier farther up the supply chain. So a Chinese company called Kofco that had been using sugar, which was made with Uyghur labor that, you know, some said was forced labor, and the company has said that it also carried out an audit of that as well. So often
I should mention, Anna, here that the Coca-Cola sent us a statement disputing, saying that the Coca-Cola company was not lobbying against the bill, but also that they did not import goods from the U.S. into the U.S. from the Kafko Tune or Xinjiang regions.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I mean, often it's far up in the company supply chain. You know, it could be an instance of raw materials. It could be forced labor that's happening at a contract manufacturer. So not a factory that, you know, is directly under the brand, but somebody that the company is contracting with in China.
And so Coca-Cola, in this case, is it feasible that they would be unaware of that, or any of these companies would be unaware of these links in their supply chain?
Well, there is quite a bit of opacity in Chinese supply chains. So I think that that's something that people will argue about, whether or not these companies should have a better handle on their supply chains. But if you do go farther up, you go, you know, several steps removed, it's conceivable that, you know, companies might not have a great grasp on what's going on there.
How much of an effect? I mean, this is something that's coming out as having bipartisan support, which is, Anna, as you know, rare these days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this bill is really interesting because it dovetails with some of the interests of Republicans, who has taken an increasingly critical eye towards China, as well as the interests of Democrats, who see forced labor as a big issue, and definitely want to work with the incoming Biden administration on that. So the bill, I do think, stands a good chance of being passed by the Senate and could be signed into law either by the Trump administration or the incoming Biden administration.
Anna, how much leverage do companies or major corporations like Apple, Nike, and Coca-Cola have with the Chinese government when it comes to addressing labor issues within China?
That's a great question. I do think that their leverage is quite limited. And on the whole, you see companies not really wanting to be put in this position of, you know, having to choose between public relations issues in the United States and their relations with the Chinese government. And that's why, you know, much of this lobbying around issues like this does go on kind of in secret, and companies are very wary of being outed. But it definitely does not benefit these companies to be, you know, out publicly criticizing the Chinese government, and it doesn't really benefit them in the United States to be in a position of seen as, you know, opposing regulations on forced labor, right? So it is a tricky position for them.
And I guess the question is, what would be something that would get these companies out of China, you know, ultimately, if these abuses were found to be true? Would it be enough to move the needle for them to leave the country altogether? Or is it just too enticing to want to stay in China?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, what is likely to happen then is if this legislation does go through, it is really broad legislation that has very significant implications for supply chains in China. It could take, you know, companies many months to prove to the U.S. government that their supply chains are free of forced labor. In the case of big companies, they probably have the resources to do that, and they'll be able to do that. You know, maybe for smaller companies, it will be more difficult. But one thing you see is companies kind of trying to look at their supply chains, you know, either ensure that they're free of forced labor, move out of Xinjiang, maybe move to other parts of China, or just kind of rejig things so that they know that the stuff they're importing to the United States comes from outside of China, or, you know, places that are definitely free of forced labor, but they can still use those Chinese factories to send stuff to the rest of the world. I mean, these are multinational companies, so they're supplying goods everywhere. So they might just, you know, take the approach of cracking down on that part of the supply chain that actually touches the United States in response to this.
China's treatment of the Uyghur Muslim population is what is considered by many a human rights atrocity and violation. The Biden administration will be taking office shortly. I'm wondering what their approach, if we know, to American companies doing business in China, given this, would be.
Yeah, I think that they are. This is an issue that they're going to take on very seriously. There is momentum, you know, bipartisan momentum, really, to take on more of this issue, a recognition that, as you said, there are really some atrocities going on in Xinjiang, you know, reports there of mass detentions. But also, you know, very tight restrictions on movement that really prevent companies and auditors from investigating supply chains there. So the Chinese government says that's all about security, about poverty alleviation. But I think there's a growing awareness in the United States that companies and U.S. Buyers do not want to be associated with that.
Anna Swanson is a reporter covering trade and international economics for The New York Times. Anna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find Nike's and Coca-Cola's full statements on this story online at thetakeaway.org. And we also reached out to Apple and have not heard back yet, but we'll add their comments to our website if we do.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Have you ever been called out for something on social media? Publicly shamed for a comment someone deemed inappropriate or wrong? Have you ever called someone out? In our Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter world, that happens a lot. But what does it actually accomplish? And could there be a better way to get across a message to someone spreading hate or misinformation online? Professor Loretta J. Ross thinks there is. She's a visiting associate professor in the Program for the Study of Women and Gender at Smith College, where she teaches an alternative to calling out, known as calling in. I spoke with Loretta about this and about how her own history as a radical Black feminist has informed her view of so-called call-out culture and cancel culture. First off, she explained exactly how she defines the call-out.
Calling out is publicly shaming people for what they've said, what they wear, how they look. Basically, it's publicly shaming people for what they think and who they are. And it usually is done over social media, but not exclusively. It certainly can be done in public or at the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever. But it's about trying to hold someone accountable, but doing it in such a public way that they're going to experience shame and humiliation.
Now, you mentioned two things that I think are important to talk about here. One is the use of social media to do this, and the other is the unforgivability element of this. And I wonder if the social media element of this has made it easier to be less forgiving in some way. How did we get here?
I think what changed by social media is the anonymity, that you're basically doing it to strangers. It's about people being able to lob these bombs into people's lives and then quickly turn their attention to something else. And the person is left devastated, no way to come back. And then it takes on a viral quality. So it's not just one person calling you out, but everybody they know who thinks they have to demonstrate how woke they are also calling you out. Then it becomes a mob. Then it becomes something totally out of your control, in such a way that even if you want to make amends, how do you make amends with a bunch of strangers who don't know you and you don't know?
You know, talking about this reminded me, I had an experience, and I've been on Twitter for 10 years, regularly tweeting, and, you know, I'm a public figure. I talk about the news mostly, and every now and then just muse on other fun topics. And, you know, there was one topic that caught a lot of attention over the summer. It was defunding the police. When you talk to people, when you actually do reporting around the topic, some people want a full abolition of all police, and other people want funds to be redistributed to community-centered programs. And there still remains a question, I think, on the top of minds of many Americans, which is what happens to the public safety mechanism if you defund the police? And I asked that question, And I had experienced some pretty serious Twitter, you know, calling out in the past, but this was at a level that was, to me, a disgrace. I was ridiculed, I was insulted, I was cursed at, and ultimately I just decided to shut it all down. And the only thing that it accomplished, Loretta, was that I just became silent because the ridicule was to a point where it became abusive. Is that considered calling out? And is that what you're targeting, that type of behavior in your class?
That's a textbook example that you just described, because we live in a pluralistic society where we're supposed to debate different issues with our different opinions. And calling out culture assumes that there's only one right way to think about something, one right way to talk about something, and only a small number of words to use to talk about it. I call it the road rage of the internet, because people have a quick twitch where they just respond, probably over the top, in a difference of opinion that they don't agree with. But then the next thing they say is, your words are making me feel unsafe. And they can't distinguish between actually being unsafe and feeling unsafe.
Some of this is coming, and a lot of this is coming from, I would say, multiple sides of the political spectrum, right? I mean, we're seeing this from uber conservative folks. We're also seeing it from very, very progressive folks who, you know, really will call people out, if, to your point, if they're not using the correct language. And a lot of people will say, look, this, we are responding to violence with violence, right? We are responding, maybe not with violence, but with that level of strength, with that level of calling out that these are institutions and ideas and things like racism or getting, you know, certain things wrong that really need to be called out and have language that's appropriate to use. So what do you say to people who say that, who say, no, this has to happen? This is the results of, you know, decades or generations of systemic inequality that are now being examined in a public forum like social media.
Well, first of all, I think that calling out is not a partisan behavior. Everybody does it. I mean, remember, Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel because he got called out. So it's not something that's terribly new. It is how human beings make judgments on each other and then try to hold them publicly accountable for them. What's interesting about the right-wing reaction to call-out culture is they try to blame it on the left. When I seem to recall something about Salem witch hunts that happened a long time before the left was created, and we really have this as part of our human behavior. Now, I am, as a human rights activist, more concerned about the left, because I feel that while the Republicans organize to take power, we organize to debate each other and call each other out. And I think that there's a problem with that, because the majority of our country believes in the same values we do of equality, fairness, justice, kindness, but we're not using those techniques within our movement on each other. And that's why I'm writing the book on call out culture. But it wasn't a problem when it was the powerful calling out the vulnerable. It only now has become this, oh, we've got to stop this process, particularly on the right, because it's the previous victims calling out their violators. But that, having said that, I really do think that we have to not violate people's human rights in the effort of building a human rights movement, otherwise we're contradicting our own work. And I am concerned about how we do it on the left.
Now, you have an alternative to calling out, which is calling in. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really simple. A calling in is a call out done with love. So you're still seeking to hold people accountable, but instead of coming at it with anger or rage or shame, you're saying, you know, when you use that word, it didn't land on me quite correctly. Do you think we can go have coffee and talk about it? Or you could come back and say, you are a racist and you shouldn't be using those words. I mean, those are choices we get to make. It's not about evading accountability or not seeking justice, but it's about not dehumanizing the person who has done what you think is wrong and offer them the same expectation of being a complicated person just like you are. And instead, we flatten people out to what we think is their worst behavior. And that's who they are. And whatever their social or identity is, if they're a white male, then this is what all white men do. If you're a black woman, this is what all black women do. I mean, we just get into these angel devil gladiatorial debates, which really aren't even realistic and doesn't represent how human beings actually work. So calling in is offering that grace, giving people the benefit of the doubt, helping them rethink what they just said or did, because I find very useful just the phrase, I beg your pardon. It makes them stop and say, oh, let me rewind this in my head and see if that came out the way I meant it. Or you could say, you know, I used to use the word cripple before somebody told me how ableist that was. And so would you mind us talking about other words we can use?
I want to talk about burdens here, because there is some criticism to that approach. And some people would say, well, you're asking people who are marginalized or persecuted to now call in someone, you know, with love who might be, you know, acting terribly towards them, right? And why is there even a burden to call someone in?
No, calling in always has to be voluntary, because you have to be in a space that you self-assessed that you're healed enough from your trauma in order to offer that extension of grace, which requires you to do emotional investment in another person's growth. Well, that should not be obligatory. That's a choice you get to make. But that doesn't mean someone who's a bystander watching it happen can't become the person that calls in. I'm a rape survivor, but my rapes were 4 decades ago. So I'm in a better place to call in someone who commits violence against women than someone whose rape is more recent or less healed. So no, it is not an obligation to invest in another person's growth. It's a choice that you have, and it's a choice you make because you want to be the best person you can be, that you're not going to let your trauma-informed lenses determine how you see other people. But my friend Sonya Renee Taylor, who wrote the book, The Body is Not Apology, she has a midway point. She calls it, I don't do calling out, I don't do calling in. What I do is I call on people to be better human beings. And in that way, I don't have to make an emotional investment in them, but I am setting a standard that I hope they work to live up to.
Are there people who should just shoulder the burden of being called out? People like politicians, people like myself who are public figures. Should we just expect to be called out and have to deal with that?
I think so, because we are going to be visible objects of people's trauma. That's just the human being. That's the way life is. And the thing is, we can't internalize their trauma, though. And only reason it has the power to wound us many times, unless it's actual threats, of course, is because we're still questioning whether or not we've done the right thing. And we should be always questioning that, as a matter of fact. And so sometimes calling out of a public figure is used to make them do the right thing, to make them rethink what they've said or done. I mean, if Colin Kaepernick hadn't knelt, do you think the NFL would be putting Black Lives Matter signs on the stadiums? You have to do it sometimes to call attention to what is wrong. But there's no way to keep people from acting on their own opinions and trauma. And I'm a writer. Every time I throw my writing out there into the universe, I feel like I'm walking naked through the street and inviting people to critique my body. That's what it is when you lift your voice in the public commons. And it's part of making that choice to be that public figure. But you don't have to internalize it personally.
I want to ask you a question about your own personal experiences with calling in versus calling out. Because you have called in. You mentioned earlier that you are a rape survivor and that you survived those experiences that happened more than 4 decades ago. And as part of your work, you have worked with rapists and calling them in. That's not something that a lot of people will do, Loretta.
Well, it was something that I felt compelled to do when I was the director of the DC Rape Crisis Center back in the 70s. Because we got this letter from one man who was incarcerated for raping and murdering a Black woman. And he said, literally, outside I raped women, inside I'm raping men, and I don't want to be a rapist anymore. And I mean, we didn't immediately respond, oh, for joy, let's go work with this rapist. We sat on this letter for months, agonizing on whether our small agency had the capacity to deal with perpetrators when we were strained to the guts trying to deal with victims. And finally, I got in my car and drove to Lorton Reformatory, which was the prison that DC used, and sat down and talked to William Fuller, the guy who wrote the letter. And William talked about how when he was 18 years old, he had raped and murdered a girl who was 17 years old. And now that he was 35, he was rethinking his whole life. And he was honest. He was sincere. We made a deal that we weren't going to do anything that would benefit him in terms of parole or bringing in stuff, but we would give him consciousness around violence against women through a Black feminist lens. And William went on to found Prisoners Against Rape, the first male-led organization movement by men to end violence against women. And I've also had to call in ex-Klansmen, people who were in the Aryan Nations, because I worked with the late Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was an aide to Dr. Martin Luther King. And he told us that when you ask people to give up hate, then you need to be there for them when they do. And I didn't like that message. I wanted to curse, but you can't curse in front of a minister. But he was right. And once I started to meet people who were part of the hate movement but had left it, I saw them as human beings and not just people in robes, people with swastikas on their arms. And once you know somebody's humanity, then you can't just stereotype them. You just can't dismiss them. And actually, that kind of frustrated me, because if a Black girl can't hate the Klan, I mean, who's left? It's like I had to reset my entire worldview. And Reverend Vivian taught me about calling in with love instead of hate, even though I didn't have the words for that back in 1990.
And as a radical Black feminist, Loretta, was there call-out culture in your experience back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, when you were doing a lot of this work initially?
Well, we used to call it trashing back then. We didn't have the word call out. Or we would say, particularly in the Black movement, you are not relevant. And that was the worst burn you could give somebody back then. So, of course, we had it growing up. And I've also been a caller out and really made mistakes, because I used to think that I was the one that had to hold people accountable to this very high standard. And I regret every call out I made, particularly the first, the largest one I did over social media, because I felt that a person I was working with stole some of my intellectual property and went around bragging to my funders that she had created the theory of reproductive justice when I knew she hadn't, because I was there. We did it. Black women did it, not her. And she wasn't Black. So I publicly put her on blast because I was hurt. And then the reaction to me was that from my position of power and the authenticity, since I knew the truth, I could have chosen a different way rather than totally humiliating a woman 30 years younger than me. And they were right. I've always regretted calling her out, because I got defined as her bully instead of her victim, because I wasn't looking at the power differentials. I wasn't looking at the effects of how words done over social media just become viral. And of course, everyone that experienced her reaction saw her in tears. And of course, I had used my power to overwhelm her, even though I felt I was the injured party. I've always regretted that.
Loretta, you've also been called out in different ways. And one of those ways was when you signed on to a letter at Harper's with other folks who had been roundly called out, including J.K. Rowling. That letter was very roundly criticized by a lot of folks, particularly in more progressive intellectual circles. You were called out as part of the team of folks who signed it. What were your thoughts on that?
At first, I was amused, because there's a delicious irony to being called out for writing a letter about the call-out culture. So I was like, well, you just proven my point. But what I was also bothered by was that the assumption that call-outs should not be criticized by people on the right and on the left as poisoning and coarsening our political discourse. We should be able to disagree with all of our passion, but without resorting to personal attacks, death threats, cancellations, costing people's jobs. I mean, that's just going too far. So because it had signatures on the left, on the right, including J.K. Rowling, who I understand has made some very transphobic remarks that I probably don't agree with, I was just lumped together with everyone that they had a critique of who signed the letter. And I think it's a lack of accurate nuance and threat assessment. I mean, I have a 50-year human rights career that they just didn't take into account when they accused me of trying to pamper the sensibilities of rich white men on the Upper East Side. I'm not even a New Yorker, so I had to figure out, what are they talking about, the Upper East Side? But
Loretta, you teach a class at Smith, which a lot of people won't have access to, but you're trying to expand that. Tell us about that.
When COVID happened and we were sent home from Smith, I thought deeply about what I had to offer. So starting in the summer, I started making my classes on calling in the calling out culture available online for $5 a lecture, because I wanted to keep it very affordable for people, because I want to create a culture shift of how we do this, because I really do believe that calling in is going to be to the 21st century and our social justice practices, like nonviolence was in the 20th century and how it affected social justice practices. So I teach it online. My website is lorettaross.com if you want to know more information. And usually 400 to 500 people from all over the country sign up for it because they're desperate and thirsty for a new way to achieve accountability without all the harm and the pain and the tears and the shaming.
Loretta J. Ross is a visiting associate professor in the program for the study of women and gender at Smith College. And her forthcoming book is called Calling In the Calling Out Culture, Detoxing Our Movement. Loretta, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
All right, folks, one more thing before we go today.
This is elections. This is the backbone of democracy. And all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this. I can't begin to explain the level of anger I have right now over this. And every American, every Georgian, Republican and Democrat alike should have that same level of anger.
I heard this audio from Gabriel Sterling, the voting system implementation manager in Georgia and a lifelong Republican. Sterling was responding to death threats against GOP officials in Georgia, as well as the president's continued baseless accusations of election fraud, with an urgent message to his party and to President Trump. It's compelling and emotional and definitely worth a listen.
It has all gone too far. Joe DeGeneva today asked for Chris Krebs, a patriot who ran CISA, to be shot. A 20-something tech in Gwinnett County today has death threats and a noose put out saying he should be hung for treason. Mr. President, you have not condemned these actions or this language. Someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to get shot. Someone's going to get killed. And it's not right.
That's it for us today. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.